Okay, so we're up to the last stage of this epic saga, and this is the punishment stage. That's how all good horror stories have to end, the punishment of the protagonists, and the Torah takes each one in its own stage. And we begin, as we'll actually see one of the commentaries pointing out, it's deliberate, but we begin with the snake. And it's interesting, there's actually two different psukim, one much more well-known than the other, that focus attention on the snake and its punishment. And I would like to read with you maybe one Rashi about the second pasuk and offer some very superficial comments about that Rashi. But really, I too want to focus on the first of these two psukim, which happens to be the more well-known and more tangible, I think, one and more accessible pasuk. So the two psukim I'm referring to, the actual punishment where God for the first time turns his attention to the Nachash, because again, we've seen him talking to Adam and we've seen him talking to Chava, and now he will turn his attention to the Nachash. And we will note, I think, the imbalance that I just alluded to, which is that both Adam and Chava are spoken to, so to speak, given a chance. They didn't exactly do a great chance of defending themselves, and subsequently Hashem is going to return his attention to them to give them their punishment, to pronounce a sentence, whereas the snake has not been spoken to yet. This is the first address to the snake, and these are the two psukim that we will be focusing on this evening, psukim Yud Dalid and Tesvav. So let's take a look and read these, and as I said, the first pasuk is more well-known, it's also more accessible, and not coincidentally, it will also be the focus of tonight's shir. But let's read them both, so that Emir Tashem, next week, we can pick up with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's address to Chava. So tonight we begin Pasuk Yudalid in Perek Gimel, V'yomer Hashem Elokim El HaNachash. And it's worth noting that both names of God here are used as kind of implying a comprehensive, you know, approach. Midas Adin, Midas Arachamim, it's all there. The snake can't escape, you know, any aspect, so to speak, of divine attention. And what does God tell the snake? Ki asisa zos, because you have done this. This meaning, presumably, inciting Chava. Arur ata mikola behema. You are cursed from all of the animals. Umikol chayasa sadeh. From any of the other wild animals in the field. In what way will you be cursed? Presumably that this is supposed to be now qualified. Unless we have a different explanation. But for now, I would assume that. Al gechon cha seleich. You will have to crawl on your stomach or your belly. V'afar sochal, and you'll have to eat from the dust of the earth, kol yemei chayecha, all of the days of your life. So I don't know if there's a lot of commentary on this pasuk, but I'm not sure if there's, so to speak, questions that need answer. Anyone have any comments before we move on to the next pasuk and then circle back to the mafarshim? Any comments on the pasuk? Anything strike you as worthy of attention or difficult in the pasuk? Right, good. So I alluded to that, I guess. No, it's okay. I didn't say it the way you did it, but as you were walking in, I mentioned, yes, that is the main issue. I would say the one thing that really does jump out at you as something which needs to presumably be addressed, is, and we will see it being addressed, is the fact that both Adam and Chava are addressed previously, whether it was really as a chance to do tshuva, or almost just as a way, almost a courtesy to be spoken to, and then Hashem will get back to them to pronounce the sentence. Whereas this is the first time God even gives any attention to the snake, and here there's no chance to explain himself. He's not quizzed, anything. All it is a pronouncement of the punishment against him. So that, I think, is an important observation, one which I think we will see right away that Rashi, Kun, and Chazal addressed, and there's worth commenting on. Anything else?
Yes, and one other, I remember where the one view, the snake was just a normal snake.
Yeah, we'll get back to that.
So in that case, why would
That's not necessarily a question that we would immediately be bothered by the Pasuk, but in light of the running commentary of the Abarbanel, which we addressed last week as well, and I mentioned then, Harry, that you've been a running critic of the Abar Vanel. So this is your last chance to take out the Abar Vanel, because the story is ending. The snake exits stage left, right, in the next pasuk. So we were wondering, and I said it from the moment, that there were a lot of questions on the Abar Vanel. He's tried to answer every one of them, but the first most obvious one, which we recognized at the beginning of the parak when we first saw the Abar Vanel's theory, that this wasn't a miraculous snake, it didn't have necessarily hands, it didn't have feet, and it wasn't talking, it wasn't inciting. It was just crawling up and down the tree and eating the fruit. And the Chava was so desirous, which perhaps she was instigated by the snake, that's not hard to believe, that's not impossible, but she became so desirous that she almost became, she saw things, literally, she imagined as if the snake was saying, eat the fruit. So it's again certainly not simple reading of the pasuk. It's also not simple reading of Chazal. It's really his own take on things. And we said at the time there were a lot of questions, which we've seen in the little ones, but the big one would be: so why would the snake be punished? And you just take a sneak peek. Right, you won't read the last chapter of the book, Harry, but at least sneak a peek. Turn over your sheet for a second. Tell me, what's the last source on your sheet? What's the last source? Okay, so we'll get to it. Okay, yes.
The language of this is just a poetic comment from the Torah when it says, so a snake certainly more than just dust.
Okay, good. So that's. But that's what I, that's, I truth is I didn't see anyone who really addressed this in the classical or early Mefarshim, but I had seen someone reference Rav Hirsch, and says I don't have Rav Hirsch at home, and I keep on forgetting to buy a copy, and I didn't have a chance to take a look at the Shul's copy, so I was momentarily looking at it, and when we have a chance, I'll borrow the Chumash. I don't know if Rav Hirsch does the justice, and Rav Hirsch basically says what you said. He gives a second theory, but the first thing Rav Hirsch says is basically, yes, that it's meant somewhat poetically or metaphorically, that's correct. He then gives some explanation for why this is the language that's used, but he's the only one that I saw pointed out, because I think it's correct. I don't know if it's, snakes eat all sorts of things. Right, all sorts of things. Right, they don't just eat dirt. It's just not true. Right, it's just not true. It's just not true. Okay. And if you're a little child, you're convinced that it might eat you too. Snakes is one of my big fears, so certainly more than offer. Okay. Anything else bothering you about the pasuk? I would say not so much as a pshat. I would say almost view it philosophically. One thing which I don't want to call it a bother, but a curiosity, which is maybe it's so obvious that that's why you're not thinking of it. But I'll ask it for you. Why these punishments? There's a lot of things you can do to somebody, right? How many punishments are there? So there's three clauses in the pasuk. The way I read it, said the first one was not an independent punishment, but it was like an introduction, qualified by the next two. So let's assume that it's not three. Is it two or is it one? If it's always crawling on its stomach, so maybe that's why it has to have afara, tochal, or is that two? But whether you want to call it one, you want to call it two, and even if you'll call it three, but why? In other words, we know what the snake did. Presumably the snake was culpable. But why these punishments? I mean, those are the issues, I guess. I don't have any else, but those are the things that really, that strike me. The one that Ethan mentioned, which is the fact that the snake's never given a chance to defend himself. Unlike Adam and Chava, who were addressed already, the snake just goes into the immediate punishment stage. And number two is, the bigger issue is, why these punishments of all things that you could do to something?
Or at least this may be a very minor point, right? You never think, in my opinion, Nochash as a behemoth. And we call behemoth, we call chaya, so bad.
So why both are mentioned, that's a good point. It's actually interesting. Rashi addresses this. It's a tradition of Chazal. Rashi addresses why the need for the redundancy. And I wasn't going to mention it, really, because I don't know if, again, it's one of these things where I think already the Rambam, I believe already in the Rambam's time, he noted that it did not correspond to what he called modern science, which is that Chazal, Rashi quotes it, used that phraseology as an indication of what the gestation period is for a snake. And they indicate that the snake has the longest, and this presumably is a punishment. I know my wife, each time, even in a good pregnancy, by the time she gets to 9 months, she always used to say, a pregnancy would be perfect, which is 8 months long. Even 9 months was always too long, right? So the Chazal go through each different species and why they have longer and longer, and it suggests here that a snake has a 7-year gestation. And that, needless to say, What's the big deal? Right, so take a look just for a moment, just since it was brought up. Take a look at Rashi. It's the second Rashi in Pasuk Yud Dalet. Mikol Behema Umikol Chayas Sadeh. Says Rashi, im mi behema niskalel, if it's more cursed than a behema, meaning a domestic animal, mechayel or kol shekein, isn't it obvious? Therefore, again, the implication is that you didn't need both. That's again, I think, which is what Harry was asking. According, that's the assumption of Chazal. Just so we should read it if we're here anyway. He neither Rabbi Seder Midrash there, and because of this question, the rabbis came up with the following Midrash. Lamei to teach us, Shimei Iburo Shel Hanachash, the gestation period of a snake, Sheva Shanim, is 7 years. Yeah, wow, huh? No, I said the Rambam already addressed. Right, the Rambam already notes and suggests maybe Nishtanu Hatzvayim, the nature has changed, whatever, it's a big. Affair, it's a Slufkin type topic. No joke. That's a real issue. It's, yeah, I'm looking in my chumash. I don't know what your chumash says. In my chumash, the footnote says that the species of domestic animal with the longest period of gestation is the donkey, whose pregnancy lasts a full year. This period would be 7 times longer even than that. And that is 7 times longer than the one with the shortest gestation, which is the cat, whose pregnancy is only 52 days.
So this is what I think
this is what Chazal were using. In other words, the lowest domesticated is 7, the highest that it is 52 days. The the donkey is a year, is 7 times more than that, and the snake is 7 times more than that, equals 7 years. That's the drasha of the Chazal. And because I'm not sure what relevance it would have yet if it were true, and it doesn't seem to be true, so I wasn't going to mention it. But since you brought it up, that's the Rashi. We mentioned it. Okay, so let's try to focus on some. Let's see the second pasuk for a moment. As I mentioned, now I'll say again, this is a much more enigmatic pasuk to read. It's much less well known, and it'll get much less attention from us. I wish I could say I was going to be the gibor, but I'll follow the crowd like every other mafarish and spend more time on the first pasuk. But let's just read it, and perhaps if we have time, we'll focus on one potentially controversial Rashi. So the pasuk continues in Pasuk Tezvav, the Eva Ashis, and I will put some kind of anger, enmity, fighting, Bein Cha U Bein Ha'isha, between you, right? The whole problem started with you and Chava, you got too chummy, so you know what, it wasn't so good for the world that you guys had such a nice relationship, therefore I'm going to make an enmity between you and the woman, and or womanhood, U Bein Zaracha, and not just, you shouldn't just think it's a personal battle, but this is going to be the Hatfields and the McCoys, this is going to go on forever, U Bein Zaracha, all your descendants, all the junior snakes, U Bein Zara, and all of her descendants, who, Yishuvcha Rosh, and he, and I don't know if this means Dafka Adam or humankind, will pound on you, on your head, Ba'ata Tushufenu Akev. And all you will be able to do is either nip at or hiff at, the human's heel, which obviously is a very strong, what we'd call in modern parlance, strategic imbalance. We can step on it, and it's just, nipping at the heels. So there is this second, as I say, much more enigmatic reference to the constant enmity. And it's one thing to always be in a fight, it's another thing to always be the underdog. So you're to be always in a fight where you're so clearly outmanned, if you will, that apparently is an additional type of a punishment for the snake. Okay? So now let's go back to... yes, please, doctor. Well, that's what I said when I was reading it. I'm not sure if it's Dafka switching to Adam, or it means, the way we speak about mankind. Or the children, and that's in the plural and the masculine. I'm not sure. Okay. Let's go back to the first Rashi here on Pasuk Yud Dalet. And I think the first issue to be addressed, both, if you will, from a Pshat perspective, as well as we'll see from a philosophical perspective, Midrashic perspective, is this idea of how Hashem relates to the Nachash. Right? Didn't give him a chance, right? And, if you were called in by a boss of yours, and just immediately get, third degree and get, the punishment or the whatever the penalty, without having first been found out, especially if you find out that the other three people who were involved, the other two people, they all got a chance to talk and make their case. So needless to say, we wouldn't necessarily consider it fair. We wouldn't expect it, certainly, of Hashem. Yes?
I just also think that the language of our world
Yes, yes, yeah, yes. Correct, yes. I think it works in the same direction. So in light of all of this, we need to know, why is this the case? Why did Hashem first ask the snake, hey, what'd you do? Everyone's pinning it on you, so let's find out what's your excuse. So that doesn't ever happen. Hashem just goes right into punishing the snake. So says Rashi, Kiyasisazos, first Rashi, Mikan, from this fact. And what's the this fact? This fact is exactly what we said, that Hashem does not engage in any dialogue with the snake. She'ain, we see from this the following. Mikan she'ain mahafachin b'zuchuso shel mesis. That we don't turn over, mahapechas to turn over, and this is stuff, it's a figure of speech here. We don't, so to speak, bend our heads and twist ourselves into an intellectual pretzel to try to figure out ways that could be mitigating for or defend a mesis. What is a mesis? A mesis, it's a question whether this is being used here specifically or broadly. Specifically, a mesis is a parsha itself in the Torah and refers to someone who incites another person to do avodah zarah. That's a mesis, that's a parsha in the Chumash, and it itself is a capital crime. So in theory, two witnesses could come before Bezdin and say, so-and-so was a mesis. This person was, you know, trying to get other people to do a avodah zarah. More broadly, you could see it as someone who's inciting anyone to do anything wrong. Even though just trying to get someone to eat not kosher, for example, wouldn't be a capital crime. But a mesis, in the narrow sense, is inciting someone to do a avodah zarah. And in a broader sense, it's someone who is trying to incite someone else. So say Chazal here by Rashi, we're not going to go out of our way, we're not going to bend over backwards to defend such a person. How do we know this? Because how did Hashem engage in the dialogue, which we wonder where it is, and ask the snake, hey, why'd you do this? It could have answered, Divrei Harav, V'divrei HaTalmid, Divrei Mishomim. The snake had an excuse in its arsenal, which they didn't use. Namely, they shouldn't have listened. So what did I say at the Chava? They shouldn't have listened. Who am I? I am just a Talmud. I'm one of the many students of God. You are the Rav. You're the master. You get conflicting advice or conflicting commands from the boss and from one of the lower people. So who are you supposed to listen to? Was that an excuse? The boss gave you a direct command. Don't eat from the tree. They should have ignored me. It's not my fault that they listened to me. And yet, Hashem didn't say that, didn't give him an opportunity. So say Chazal from this, we see from that that it's deliberate. But there are certain situations in which we're not looking to give someone a break. Now the background for this is, and I want to turn my attention now to the two sources on top of the page of your source sheets, the background is that there are certain, to use, if you will, a modern day references, there are certain parts of the Jewish legal system and even the punitive system and even the capital crimes, which could be, from the Jewish perspective, which would be, in modern sensibilities, would be called maybe more conservative. And there's definitely elements which are, you and I would consider more liberal, to use modern references. One of the classic examples, if you will, of the more liberal approach is the fact that this is in part, I'm being a little bit simplistic because we don't have lawyers in general in a biblical system, but given the fact that there's no lawyers, in a capital case, which requires minimally 23 judges to hear a capital case. Let's say two people come, witnesses come and say that Rabbi Gottlieb got angry at a congregant, that he fell asleep during the speech, and he lost his temper, and he hit him so hard he killed him. Right? Two witnesses come and take me to, right? They come to Beth Din. So now I'm on trial for my life. You need a court of 23 to hear it. The witnesses will come, the witnesses will be examined. So I, in theory, can try to make arguments affirmatively for my defense. Additionally, the halacha is that the Bez Din themselves, any one of the judges, can enter into evidence arguments on my behalf. The Bez Din is part, and it's a completely foreign role to what we're used to in the Western world. The Bez Din is not just a third-party objective arbiter of truth, it's that too, but it also is, and ironically enough, an advocate for the defendant. So if I, you know, like what we have sometimes in America, where they say, well, he didn't have a good enough lawyer. See, that won't happen in a Jewish system. That's a fail-safe that's built in, because not only might he argue for himself, but he has these 23 presumably bright and experienced judges who could cross-examine a witness better than he could or offer some idea, plausible defense on his behalf. We are toein, it's called tanina. We will make arguments on behalf of the defendant even if he doesn't make them for us. So that's the background. Comes along Rashi in the name of Chazal and says, but there's an exception to that. A person who is accused of being a masis, so that apparently is such a singularly terrible crime that they're on their own. If they didn't do it, if they can defend themselves, if there's not enough evidence, then we'll acquit. But we're not going to be affirmatively defending him. Ein taninon lemasis. That's the phrase. Where did that come from? Where was Rashi borrowing it from? Primarily from a Gemara in Masechta the Sanhedrin. Look at the top of your page. Just so you should know, give you a little sense of the symmetry here. Just whatever it was, 2 months ago, on the Thursday night halacha shir that I give, in which I give a halacha shir based on a topic from that week's parsha. So on Parshas Bereishis, this was my topic. I use this as my topic to speak about Ein Shteichel Dvar Avera, which is a cousin to this topic, and Ein Ta'anina Lemesis. Where does that come from? So it's this primary source in Sanhedrin 29a, Chav Tef Amar Aleph. Again, it's in the context that the Gemara there is discussing about this notion of taninan that we sometimes are defending the accused. Amar Shmuel Bar Nachman, Amar Yonasan, Minayin She'ein Tohan in Lemesis. How do you know? They have a tradition, obviously, that we don't have this role if the accused crime is to be an insider and a Mesis. Says the Gemara, what's our source? Minachash HaKadmoni, from that original early snake. Amar Rabbi Simloi. Abisimlai said, Harbe ta'anos ha'il nachash leton. We don't know what they all are, but maybe it's not meant as really as a multitude, and rather maybe it means a strong claim. The snake had a good defense. Lo ta'an. But for whatever reason, the snake never argued on his own behalf. Neima, says the Gemara, lo ta'an, lo kadosh baruch hu. Hashem, we usually say taninan. Right? Not all defendants are equipped to defend themselves. They're not all good lawyers. Maybe they're shocked, they're intimidated. So Hashem, who's acting as judge, should have also been acting, you know, we have the phrase in our English idiom, judge and jury. But the halachic idiom would be judge and lawyer, judge and advocate. How come Hashem, who's judge, but why wasn't he also advocate? Why wasn't he arguing on behalf of the snake? So the Gemara answers, Lefisha lo ta'anhu. The snake didn't argue. Hashem wasn't going to argue for him. We have a principle, doesn't really explain why, but we have a principle we see here, which we can extrapolate from for all Jewish history, Ein ta'aninan lemesis. Now as a PS, the Gemara adds, our curiosity has been piqued. Here we are, we read through the whole parak, we thought the snake was dead to rights. Now, what defense does the snake have? Here the Gemara, of all people, is telling us, no, you know, if the snake had just gone to a better law school, he would have been able perhaps to get himself off. We're not going to argue for him. We see that from Hashem's silence. But there could have been an argument. And what would the argument have been? Divrei Harav, Vidivrei Talmud, Divrei Mishomim. Which is really a rhetorical question, but just in case you weren't sure, the Gemara answer is Divrei Harav Shomim. You have conflicting instructions from the boss and from one of the employees. You always, of course, have to listen to the boss. And Hashem was the boss. Hashem told them not to eat from the fruit. They shouldn't have listened to me. The snake could have argued. Now, it's not 100% clear from the Gemara that he would have gotten off, although that is the implication. Just before we analyze this any further, there is a parallel text, which I actually was not previously aware of, but it's a parallel text from the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, just to read it so we have a full picture. V'yom HaShem Elokim Al HaNachash, paraphrasing that pasuk, says the Medrash, filling in the blanks, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Nachash Zeh, Rasha, Baal Teshuvos. You think you have all the answers, you're a Russia, this is a little bit, and like you said, you know, there's like very, right out of the box, you know, Arur, Russia, right? Don't think you get an impartial jury here. And Hashem is ready, your guns are blazing against the snake. The Im Omer Anilo, so Hashem says to himself, he's a Baal Teshuvos, this is a clever snake. On the contrary, a very clever snake. If I'll engage him in a dialogue, Mr. Snake, what were you doing? Ashab Hu Omer Li. He'll give me a good answer. Atatsi bisosam, you, God, commanded them. Vanisi bisosam, and I gave them a different command. Why did they ignore your command? V'hokul come after tzivuyai, and they went after my command. And, you know, again, it's left hanging as it was in the Gemara, whether that might have really gotten them off. And since Hashem didn't want to go there, right, sometimes it's the better form of valor here, right? Discretion. So Hashem didn't want to, you know, don't go into a fight, you might not win. Therefore, says the Medrash, Ela Kofat Alav, okay, Kofat is also a very suggestive term, kind of pounced on the snake, didn't give him a chance, Upasak Lo Zino, and Paskins for him. I mean, you can almost, you know, imagine the scene as he's being let out by the bailiff, you know, but 1 second, Dibriya Rav, Dibriya, and Hashem, you know, next case, the gavel, you know, bring in Chava, Hashem is done. Now, again, it's a little bit vague because if Hashem is actually punishing the snake, so presumably this wasn't an effective claim. And presumably there is some kind of an answer to that claim. But the Gemara and the Medrash actually never give it, which is really interesting. But just as an aside, in terms of the broader implications, so I mentioned that when I gave this Thursday night shiur a few months ago, I actually was using it in a broader context. The broader context is the following. Let's say I want to rob a bank. Shul's not paying me enough, I didn't get the raise I wanted, I'm going to rob a bank. But, you know, I'm a recognizable face around town, and I'm going to get caught, and I'm not so big and strong, and how am I going to intimidate the teller? So I engage in a partner, and I get this person, and I say, listen, you should do it. You do it. Maybe I'll give you something for it, whatever, you do it. And sure enough, on my behalf, what we'd call my shaliach, this guy breaks into the bank, and sure enough, he gets caught. So let's say a halakhic court now, right? Time of Beis Din. They bring him to court and they want to give him a big punishment because he's a ganav, he's a thief. And he says, it's not me. I wasn't doing this for me. I am Rabbi Gottlieb's shliach. So he should get punished. He was going to get the money. He should get punished. We have a concept of shliach. I can do things on your behalf which have halakhic consequence. So here, I was doing something that wasn't so good, but I'm his shliach. So I'm not doing it for me, I'm doing it for him. So does that exonerate this thief or not? So the halacha is, ein shliach l'dvar avera. You cannot use this halachic concept of shlichus, of being an agent, to get out of doing something wrong. If you do something wrong, even if it's true, we're not arguing the facts. Facts are in evidence. As that you are his agent, you're only acting on the person's behalf. It's still not going to get you out of your responsibility. And what is the rationale enunciated by the Gemara? Divrei HaRav, Divrei HaTalmud, Divrei Mishum. So this is like a subsect of that larger category, right? So this is where, you know, the question, so the question is, in light of that, and I gave you an example of this in a different category, but let's say now I'm a Mises, right? Rabbi gone dead, you can just see the headlines. Not enough people were listening to my drushes when I preached good things, so now I'm going to start preaching bad things. I'm going to start trying to convince people they should worship Avodah Zarah and they should keep Shabbos, and, you know, maybe I'll get more of an audience that way. So now they're really going to stop me before the Beis Din. So what am I going to say? Rabbi, is it really true? Two witnesses, right? There were two people who stayed up for the drusha, and they say that they heard that you were, you know, telling people not to keep Shabbos. So what am I going to argue? Divrei HaRav, but Divrei HaTalmud, Mishamim. They shouldn't have listened to me. And what's the implication you get from this story, from the Gemara? The snake didn't argue it. He didn't get a chance to argue it. But would he have argued it? Could he have gotten off? I don't know. Sounds like it. So who asked this? So it's like the Gemara itself is giving an escape clause for every person to do this terrible thing of inciting other people. So Tosfos is already bothered by that question. Tosfos asked this question. Isn't the Gemara letting on like a dirty secret, so to speak? So Tosfos says no. If you take a look at the third source, this is really just as an aside, but to me it was like so bothersome, I had to figure out what the answer was, so we'll find out that the Tosfos addresses this. Tosfos says, 1 second, him Tamar, in case you'll ask, Kol Mesis Yipater Atzma Bo Sataina. Every person will ever always get them, they'll always get them, exonerate themselves, always get themselves off the hook by using this very argument. The snake didn't get a chance, but, you know, maybe I'll get a chance, I'll get a big mouth, I'll get it out before the court quiets me. So Tosfos answers, Yishlomar de Davka Nochosh. Only the snake could have gotten off. It sounds like from Tosfos the snake would have gotten off, but it would have been unique. Shalonit Stava Sholahasis, right? The snake was never given a command, don't incite Adam and Chava to do anything wrong. It wasn't, it may sound intuitive or logical, but it wasn't commanded, so therefore the snake could have gotten out of it. Lonerash Elavisha Basa Takola Al Yodo. And therefore Tosfos says something very intriguing. But really, 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 if he would have pled ignorance, that would itself have been okay. But never, that might have also been true. But nevertheless, because such great calamity occurred as a result of his actions, he deserved to be punished anyway, which is itself a very interesting concept. Avalmesis, but in general, for all future generations, someone who is a mesis, should establish lo lahasis. So, but the Torah now already tells us, right? We didn't get to it. We're only in the third paragraph of the Torah. But eventually the Torah will get to it, and the Torah will tell us, you're not allowed to be a mesis. It's a capital offense. Therefore, nimsa kishemesis over. So even though the person shouldn't have listened to you, you yourself are in violation. Now, there's still two questions, really getting back to the actual snake in the actual garden, two questions which I think are addressed in the next two mafarshim. The first question, which is really interesting in a certain sense, is I mentioned that really, in a narrow sense, halachically, the unique punishment of a capital, being killed is only if you are trying to convince someone, incite them to do a avodah zarah. Not if you're trying to get them to be mechalal Shabbos or to not keep kosher. So the Chizkuni, in the next source, it's just a one-liner. He asks, Im Tomar, Hakaim Alon Dein Mesis El Avodah Zarah. The snake didn't try to get them to Avodah Zarah. The snake got them to try to eat a fruit. So what's so bad about that? I mean, it's not good, but that's not a capital offense. That's not so terrible. That's not what's called a Mesis. So Chizkuni answer is, El Mid Amar Lo. What did the snake say to Chava way back when? That you should eat from the fruit, and therefore you will be Fihisem Kelokim, you'll be godlike. We saw different mafarshim what that means, godlike. But that itself was a type of avodah zarah. Shmamina hayna avodah zarah. We could add that we saw all sorts of mafarshim, right, that said that the snake claimed that he created the world, right? The snake claimed that he created the world, and that, you know, I'm sorry, not that he created the world, that there was this tree that had created the world. So that's certainly heretical. That could count as avodah zarah, if you could say. So one way or the other, it's just interesting that the Chizkuni does not want to look at this as just a colorful, non-literal, you know, just in the general sense. No, he says Mesis means literally Avodah Zarah, and even though we don't think of necessarily the snake in these terms, really, what was going on here was not just incitement for to eat a fruit, it was getting at the heart of the most basic foundations of belief. Now, the last thing I want to see on this particular part is the Radak. It's an incredible piece by the Radak, and it's incredible because he turns everything on its head. Or at least, in a certain sense, he argues with everything we've seen until now. Because what we've seen until now is that it's true that Hashem didn't give the snake a chance to argue, defend himself, but it's very clearly implied, almost explicitly stated, that had the snake been given the chance, was virtue to his argument. There was an answer. The snake could have answered. Hashem didn't give him the chance. But there would have been something for the snake to say. In light of that implication, so the comments, which is really all the mafarshim from Rashi, Chizkuni, the Gemara, the Medrash, they're all working with that assumption. And they're pointing out that nevertheless, you see from this, that we don't give certain people a chance. Not everyone deserves a chance for that. If they didn't do it, they didn't do it. But we're not going out of our way to try to prove that for them. However, the Radak looks at the whole story completely differently. And to the best of my knowledge, he's the only Mefarish like this. Says the Radak, also sensitive in a pshat level to the fact that the snake is not given a chance to defend himself. Says the Radak, Hu lo haya ma'ane, lo shum taina. He didn't answer anything, and he couldn't have answered. He would not have had a leg to stand on, literally or figuratively. Ki adam v'ishto adam en chava. They didn't exactly have a strong, courageous, compelling, moral, winning argument. But they had a little bit. Chava could say, listen, I got tricked by the snake. And Adam could say, I got tricked by my wily wife. You know, again, turns out, Kamash Mulan, that they shouldn't have been tricked. And they're responsible for that. But, you know, he made me do it. Right? They may have been the first, but they're not the last to make such an argument. And there's always some level of, if it in fact is true that someone got you to do something, so that's a little bit of an argument. Sometimes it's mitigating. It may not get you out of ultimate responsibility, but it's not nothing, says the Radak. However, Abel HaNachosh, lo hoy lo taina, he had nothing to argue. Laficha kilu miyad. Therefore, Hashem didn't give him a chance even to enunciate or articulate his weak argument, because there was no argument to be made. He didn't wait for him until he answered. He just went right into punishing him. Because Hashem knew there was nothing for the snake to say. Why? And here's the key line. How does the Radak Taicha, what was particularly evil about the snake? Who diber kineged mitzvah sakel? He was speaking, obviously, in direct contradiction to what God had said. Behisi as a isha, and he tricks or persuades the woman, incites the woman to do the wrong thing. Behu lo hayelo shum hanopasa. And he wasn't even getting anything out of it. It was just pure, unadulterated mischief. Pure, unadulterated evil. So therefore, there's no excuse. No one made him do anything. No one tricked him. No one, Now, I'm just thinking aloud that perhaps, I wonder, we saw a medrash that said that the snake had seen Adam and Chava being intimate, and that's what kind of... So I wonder if perhaps the Radak is just rejecting that medrash. Because I don't know if you could be as strong as he was if you accepted that medrash.
Yes, all of those that he wanted Chava and he was jealous.
Right, because then again, because he says here there was nothing, right, because he makes him seem like this is someone who's just, doing bad for bad sake. So it could be, again, it's interesting to know. I think that's not itself, as we'll see in a moment, the Radak is aware that he's rejecting, right? Well, that's already going back into your memory banks from a month ago. What about from 10 minutes ago? What's the Radak obviously rejecting? Everything we see until now. Right? The Gemara was implying that the snake would have had a good argument. Hashem just wanted to give him a chance. It's like, I once, not long ago, I read a submission online by Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein from Ula and the Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. At the OU West Coast Convention, he agreed to, so to speak, debate Dennis Prager. So he wrote in his post-mortem, so to speak, of the event, how it was like, one of the most foolish things he ever did. I mean, he knew ahead of time. Like, you don't win a debate with somebody like Dennis Prager. You just hope not to lose too badly. Right? So that's kind of what reminded me, Lahavdil, with this. Hashem was knowing, as to use the Medrash, the snake is a Baal Tshuvos. The snake knows how to get out of things. The snake was smart. The snake was cunning. The snake had arguments. So Hashem, Rabbi Alistair didn't have this chance, but, he didn't give the snake the room to breathe. He just gave him the punishment, and that's it. So that is a very different impression that you get from the Radak, who added his way to say, no, the snake had nothing. The other Makaros seemed like the snake had such a good argument that Hashem didn't want to give him a chance to express it. And in fact, it's such an obvious contradiction that the Radak himself is aware of it. But he doesn't care. Take a look, he continues. He quotes our Gemara, our Medrash, that really the snake, the Chazal have a different interpretation. But Omar Ani, and again, I think this is a very strong argument by the Radak, I have to say. The Radak says, I reject that Gemara. Ki ze lo haya taina, ela l'chayev es adam. When we generally say this argument of Divrei HaRav, Divrei HaTalmud, so that's not to exonerate the person who started the ball rolling, what we call in halacha, the mishalayach. That is to obligate the agent. The agent can't pass it off and say, listen, like in the mob movies, I'll make a deal with you. I'll give you the guy on top of me. But let me go. I was just doing his work. So that doesn't fly in halacha. The agent takes responsibility. Because this argument, Divrei HaRav, says you have to take responsibility. That's an argument to obligate the one who actually did it. But that's not the same thing as saying that, well, because you're going to be guilty, the guy above you is going to get nothing. That's not addressed at all. Who said that the person who sent you is not going to get punished? It just means that you are going to get punished. Says the Radak. This argument wouldn't have gotten the snake out of anything. It's a good argument for why Adam and Chava should get punished. That's not a good argument for why he should have gotten off. Elo lifkor sa'atzmo min ha'asata lo'hai elo taina. But to get himself free, to get himself exonerated from the fact that he persuaded, connived, cajoled Adam and Chava to do what they did, that's not an argument that they shouldn't have listened. You shouldn't have spoken. That they shouldn't have listened is their fault. But that has that excuse you for opening your mouth.
Was it an argument to make his punishment less?
So, I guess that would be maybe what the Elmer Farsham said. I'm not sure about the rest.
The Chizkuni, is a very powerful statement. The punishment is not because Chava and Adam sinned. Punishment to the snake is because
sin.
You're denying God's...
right. So you're putting that together with the Radak.
No, pardon me?
That is with the Radak?
The Chizkuni and Radak work very well. Because
fine. So just interesting that seems to be left. There's a certain vulnerability in what Rashi says and really what the Gemara says, which is, again, it leaves the implication that the snake could have gotten off. And Radak says, but why? That's an argument to obligate, to make guilty Adam and Chava. It's not an argument to get himself off. Again, you could perhaps, maybe Joel's right, or maybe there's another argument, I'm not sure, to defend Chazal, but it's interesting, these two different perspectives. You know, at the end of the day, did the snake have this great argument that it was, you know, so to speak, in his quiver, that he never got to take out? So the majority opinion seems to say yes, but Radak makes a very spirited argument that it's not true at all. And again, you draw completely opposite lessons, again, from the fact, again, let's re-anchor this back in the text. They're both confronted, both approaches are being confronted by, in this case, the absence, right? Sometimes it's a word or an evident, you know, sometimes it's a pasuk or a word that gives you a problem or draws your attention, or sometimes it's the absence. Everyone is bothered by the same thing, and it's the absence. It's the absence of a dialogue between Hashem and the snake. Hashem just comes out and pounces on the snake, doesn't give the snake an option. And again, it's obviously highlighted by the fact that in the immediate preceding psukim, Hashem did give Adam and Chava a chance. So both are bothered by this. Because they have opposite understandings, they also draw opposite conclusions. So the majority approach that Rashi says, based on the Medrash and the Gemara, is that really the snake had an argument. A better argument than Adam and Chava. And because of that, Hashem was so upset at the snake, he didn't want to risk, so to speak, getting him off. And therefore, he did an expedited trial, right? Habeas corpus, right? We can throw in all the legal terms. And he just banged the gavel, send him to the gallows, he's out of there. Right? And not only did that happen, says this majority opinion, but we can even draw a halachic principle for all generations from this. That there is, if you have the unique coda of this crime, you know, what's called the mesis, you're inciting other people to sin. Again, it's fascinating. That's worse than anything you could possibly do yourself. For a murderer, taninen, we'll try to help him get off if he's really innocent. But for a masis, that's what he's accused of. If he can get off on his own, good for him. But we're not going to help him because apparently there's something uniquely evil about that. And what's our precedent in history and legal law? The snake. That's all the majority opinion. The Radak disagrees with every step of the process. The only thing they agree with is on the first thing, which is why didn't Hashem give him a chance? So the Radak makes one assumption right away, which is radically different. Namely, the reason he didn't give him a chance wasn't because the snake was so smart, the snake had such a good argument. On the contrary, Adam and Chava deserved the hearing, even though they were going to lose, because at least they had what to argue. But the snake had nothing from nothing, garnished, had nothing to argue. All he was evil for evil's sake, just a mischievous person for no good reason, whatever. The snake had nothing, and therefore Hashem needs to waste his time. Hashem's not spinning his wheels. Hashem gave Adam and Chava a chance because they deserved one. The snake didn't deserve a chance. Therefore, Hashem pounces on him right away. And Hashem feels, and the Radak feels so strongly about this, that he even points out a vulnerability in the Gemara, which is that this argument, which the Radak accepts, it's a principle of Jewish law when it comes to the Mesis or Ein Shlech L'Dvar Avera, but the way it's used in this particular Gemara, says the Radak, is very troubling because it implies, especially the way Rashi and others use it, that the snake could have gotten off on some level. So the Radak, I don't understand. This is never used in halacha as a way of getting the mashaleach off. It's a way of indicting the shaliach, the one who actually did the crime. He can't just pass it off on the person who got him to do it. I'm representing him. I'm an agent of her. That doesn't work. Because we say, no, if you did the crime, you really got to pay the time. Because ein shleach l'dvar aveira. But what's that got to do with getting the snake off? And that's really the way we leave it. But again, two different, they both start from the same beginning. Why didn't Hashem give the snake a chance? They go in opposite directions. Okay? I have nothing more to add on this. Any other questions? Alright, so let's move on. The next issue which I want to mention, well, first of all, just as an aside, if you take a look at the next Bereishis Rabbah, it's just an interesting point in terms of the order. The order of punishments is inverted from the order of the story, basically, or certainly the order that they're addressed, right? Adam Chava, a snake Adam Chava, and here we have, snake Chava Adam is the punishments, even though they were addressed where Adam was addressed, and then he blames on Chava, who blames on the snake. So we're going in reverse order. It's like a domino effect. So Radak, the Bereishis Rabbah here, this is quoted by other Mefarshim, point out that, again, there's a certain moral principle here, and that is that when you're punishing, you start with the lowest player, so to speak. That's, you know, when you're punishing, you save a little bit of a dignity for the most respected person, even though they can get punished, but you preserve their dignity in a sense by waiting for them to go last. As opposed to in cases where you're going to reward people, the gedula or the bracha, so then, again, the same principle just has the opposite result. You want to, so to speak, highlight the one who's most important, and therefore you give them the bracha first. So it's a deliberate order, says the Bereishis Rabbah. And alternatively, other Midrashim point out that the reason we started with the snake is because he was the most culpable. We go to Chava because she is the second most culpable, and then we end with Adam, who was guilty, but certainly the least guilty of the three. So it's just interesting that the Mepharshim do note the order. Now the next two things I want to mention, which really relate to the second question we had on the Pasuk. The first question was, why didn't Hashem give him a chance? Which was Ethan's point. The other point, which I addressed, which others of you noticed as well, which is, why these punishments? Of all things you're going to do to the snake, why these punishments? Is it arbitrary, or is there some lesson here? So the first thing we need to know, again, we perhaps are subconsciously assuming it, but we should just point it out because we haven't done it explicitly until now, which is, if I told you, look at the snake, it's on its stomach, and that's a punishment. Punishment from what? It's always on its snake. It's always on its stomach. Right? So it's really, how could that be a punishment if it was always on its stomach? So that gives, again, rise to something which perhaps many of you have been assuming, but we haven't seen it really inside yet, so we'll take a look at two midrashim now, where you see this tradition in Chazal, in fact, the snake was not always on its stomach. Take a look at the bottom source. This is actually from the beginning of our perek, before there was a punishment, just when the snake entered the scene. So if we were imagining it, did the snake wiggle onto the scene, or did he walk onto the scene in the beginning of perek Gimel? So here the Medrash tells us, Rabbi Hoshea Rabba Amar, Zikratimahaya. The snake was standing fully upright. Omeid Bakana was erect, standing up, Raglayim Hayulo, and had legs. And then turning to the back of the page, again, a companion medrash, which is now focused on our pasuk. So now, in light of that, what was the snake's punishment? Al Gichoncha, you'll have to be on your belly. Teilech, says the medrash, B'shosh Amalo Kadosh Baruch Al Gichoncha Teilech. And this, I don't know if everyone knows this particular nuance, the way the medrash frames it, Yardu Malachi Ashuri, it's a very vivid image, that the angels flew down from heaven, V'katsutsu Yadav V'raglav. It was not a painless, you know, they didn't just disappear. And it didn't evolve over time. They took, you know, they amputated the legs and the hands. And in case you were wondering, they did not use anesthesia. When the snake was in so much pain, it let out such a scream that the whole world heard the agony of the snake. That's how painful. And again, if one wanted to think of this metaphorically, so obviously there's a tremendous, you know, musr for someone who, you know, otherwise to be upright, to, you know, as we would say, be chopped down to size, is a very, very painful experience for someone to go through. I mean, Chazal, to give you, in a certain sense, out of left field, we have a halacha which relates to the same psychological phenomenon, right? That someone who is very wealthy and loses that money, so there's something Chazal say that's more painful about that than someone that was always poor. And that affects how we're supposed to give them tzedakah. Right? This notion of having been, to use the snake's term, standing upright, and then have your legs cut out from under you, is very, very painful. And perhaps if one wants to look at it metaphorically, this Chazal is giving very great expression to that. It's interesting that the Radak, I'm always fascinated when Mepharshim, this is a general phenomenon which you sometimes see, when Mepharshim, who are known to be very pshat-oriented, consciously adopt a Medrash. Right? That doesn't mean it's automatically true or historical fact, but it certainly gives more likelihood to it. Because we know, as we've alluded to before, and you're all familiar, that there are definitely a tradition in, you know, certainly in Rishonim, that sometimes view these midrashim as being allegorical. Sometimes there's a certain tendency to think we're going to be frum, we're going to show our loyalty to Chazal and believe every word they say literally. And it's a nice tendency, except for that the Rambam calls you a fool. The Rambam says you're doing more harm than good. To assume that these very extravagant midrashim are meant to be literally is to assume the Chazal were fools. You're not doing any of them favors. On the contrary, you're degrading them. Really, if you want to show how much you are in awe of Chazal, you should acknowledge that these are actually incredibly complicated and sophisticated and multi-level metaphors. So as a general inclination, that's the Rambam. And there's definitely, though, another tradition which has always seen these midrashim as more literal. So whenever you have the Rambam or someone like his ilk who takes a midrash literally, So that obviously is much more, you know, impactful than if you have someone who generally, like Rashi, just quotes Midrashim necessarily without making that caveat. So my impression has always been that the Radak is in that school. I'm not a Radak expert, but my impression is that the Radak is certainly known as a very pshat-oriented commentary. And here it's interesting, the Radak, he quotes Chazal, and he certainly assumes it to be true. He weaves it into his commentary. Radak assumes that this is not a metaphorical, again, as we'll see from the Barbanel, so this is not a metaphorical tradition, but that that snake was not like your everyday snake. That snake didn't just talk, but that snake could walk. If you see the Radak here, he says, Amru Rabbeinu Zal, the snake used to walk upright like a human. It's literally true, and it's also a moral. You might have thought this was all meant to be a metaphor and a moral. Says the Radak, I'll give you, so to speak, a third approach. It's not literally true only, or a metaphor only, it's both. It was literally true. But the Radak addresses our question. Our question was, why this punishment? Says the Radak, to teach a moral lesson. The ultimate, the first cause, if you will, the prime fault of the snake was, he was arrogant. But he thought he could play around. God said one thing, I'll get you to do another thing. God wanted Adam to marry Chava, I want to marry Chava. I can do what I want. He was arrogant. He thought he could compete with God. So as a way, so in that sense, again, it's not just that he literally stood up, figuratively, that was his personality. Says the Radak, and therefore, as a way of punishment, we could have punished him for something else. You could have punished him that he'd have horrible indigestion the rest of his life. Right? You could have punished him that, I'm thinking of all sorts of things which I would be very impolitic to say. So, all sorts of things that you would consider undesirable. Right? A lot of things. Right? He would have had to have this kind of job. He would have had to be married to so-and-so. Right? All sorts of things. There would have been very horrible punishments. But that's not what Hashem did. Why did Hashem give him this punishment? Says Radak, we have a moral principle. First, again, just to think about it for a moment, you're making we're reading history here, right? This is the first punishment in history. There have been a lot since then. This was the first one, and a very, you know, consistent principle in biblical punishment and understanding of our theology of Schar V'Onesh is that we very often have the principle of Mida Keneged Mida. Hashem doesn't punish randomly, but He tries to tailor the punishment to fit the crime. Says the Radak, that started right here at the beginning. The snake stood erect in a figurative sense as well. It was arrogant. So Hashem cut him down to size the same way you and I use that phrase idiomatically. He humbled the snake. And that's why the snake got this punishment. Radak is so persuaded by this theme that he adds another layer to it. When the pasuk continues and says it's going to eat dirt, says the Radak, Mida Keneged Mida, once again, the punishment fits the crime. Because you made Adam jealous, you made Adam or Chava really here, obviously means Chava jealous by eating the fruit, and the whole parsha was based on the jealousy and the incitement all regarding fruit and how delicious this fruit was. Tilake, you will get punished. Shetocha hapachos mikol dvarim, you'll have to eat the lowest of the low. And it is the dirt. Or if we want to add, perhaps it's, I mean, literally dirt, but it's still pretty much the lowest of the low. If you take a little, I wouldn't read it inside because I'm running late, but Rav Hirsch actually is one of the ones who asked the question that snakes don't eat dirt. They eat all sorts of other things. So he has two different theories. One is that it's just a metaphor for how gross their existence is. The other one he suggests, again, I don't know the science behind it, he suggests that they don't have an ability to taste. That their tongue is not...
And all snakes swallow all their food whole, so they can't...
Right. So that he, I don't know if he made that point, although that fits with that complements what he says. He says the nature of the snake's tongue is that they don't taste, so everything tastes like dirt to them. Interesting. Yeah, interesting, right? Go reverse. Okay. So anyway, all of that is the Mida Keneged Mida that he sees in this whole parsha. The Sforno, interestingly enough, the Sforno doesn't focus on anything in particular. The Sforno has one theme throughout the whole pasuk. The Sforno says, basically, Hashem wants to make his life miserable. The main theme, says the Sforno, is not so subtle, Mida Keneged Mida, it's something differently. Misery. Misery. Why is a snake going to have to squirm on its stomach? Because it's a hard way to go. It's a hard way to go. You're going to have to try to get everywhere. It's no fun to try to get there on your stomach. Give it a try. It's very, very painful and difficult. It's just it's a more difficult and painful existence. On your stomach, it's going to be hard to get anything. You can eat dirt. Which again, perhaps he means also metaphorically, not mean literally, it means that you're no longer going to have enjoyment in physical pleasures. Eating is not going to be a pleasure for you, etc. The main theme, says the Sforno, is that you should have a painful life, and even the things that in life should be enjoyable won't be enjoyable for you. You're just going to have one big life of misery. That's the Sforno's approach. It's interesting, the Bracious Rabbah, the Medrash here, also sees a certain Musr in a metaphor in a very interesting way. Again, until I prepared this year tonight, I wasn't familiar with this idea in the Medrash. Interestingly, we have seen allusions to this, and the Medrash here has picked up on the theme that there might, we've had this come up in earlier weeks, that perhaps there never would have been death. This whole episode brought the concept of death into the world. So says the Medrash, the snake, you, the one who brought death into the world, Nevuch lo aleinu, when people are confronted with the death of a loved one in future history, what will they do? Mahalchei gechonim al miseihem. They're going to fall on their, they fall, they collapse in agony, they fall on their stomachs, they fall forward in pain over the casket, over the terrible news, and therefore, afatah gechon chaseilech. And therefore, since you, so to speak, have brought this evil to the world, this concept of death, which is, you know, symbolized by people falling on themselves, so too, you'll always have to go, you'll always have to go that way. It's a very rich medrash. Just in four lines, he says three things. That was number one. Number two, he points out, just in case you think it's all bad, Hashem never does anything all bad. Hashem always makes, again, this is obviously a good musar too, even when you're being punished, like the snake was, Hashem brings in a silver lining. What's the silver lining? That the snakes are good, can hide well. Right? Because they wiggle around and they, you know, they're slithering on the ground, you're running after them to catch them, they know how to get into the cracks, you know, in the crevices and hide from you. So even when the snake got punished, there's a silver lining. So all the more so, when things happen bad in our lives, the Medrash seems to be implying we should try to find the silver lining because there always is one. And finally, and this is one last Medrash before we're ready for Harry's Abarbanel, Medrash implicitly asks a third question, which is so, so important. I alluded to this in different drushas, which is, how is this a punishment? Much of animal history and certainly human history and misery has been about getting food, right? Resources, scarce resources. The snake never has to worry. Let's assume that it went literally. Right? There's always garbage around. There's always dirt. The snake is the one animal in the whole animal kingdom who never has to worry about having something to eat. It's always there. How is that a punishment? So the Medrash here alludes to that. And at least as the way the Radak understands it, I have the last underlined part, you shouldn't think it's so easy. Again, I don't know what the science of this is. It's not just like this is, you know, there's a smorgasbord, you know, there's dirt everywhere on the surface of the ground, and he can eat it. He has to dig deep and burrow to get whatever it is that's edible there, and therefore the Medrash seems to imply that it's actually with great effort. A different answer to the question, which is Hasidisha approach, which I always thought in the name of the Kutzker, and then I saw in a footnote in a Sefer that I have, I don't have the original, that he refers to it from the Chafetz Chaim al HaTorah, that it's the name of the Chafetz Chaim, but I always heard this in the name of the Kutzker Rebbe, which is that the ultimate goal in life is to have a relationship with Hashem. So if you have some needs, you'll always turn to Hashem. But if you have the food wherever you are, you never have any need to turn to Hashem. So it's actually the ultimate punishment is the fact that the Chafetz Chaim quotes a Mechilta, which I couldn't find. I tried searching for it on the computer, actually, of a parable of a king who got very upset with his son. So he didn't starve him to death because he's a son. What did he do? He gave him, you know, a trust fund and said, never come back. And that was the true nature of the punishment. You'll always have food, but you're not going to have anything to do with me anymore. And that was the true measure of the punishment for the snake. Now, to conclude, we're ready for Harry the Barbanel. Just to remind you, as we said in the beginning of this year, the Abarbanel from the beginning of the Perek consistently has maintained that two options that are discussed by the Mefarshim are not true. We saw one minority opinion which said the whole thing is just a metaphor. Says that he doesn't hold up. We had another group of Mefarshim, even such pshat-oriented people like the Ephen Ezra, who were forced to accept the Pasuk as it's literally said. Apparently there was a snake that used to walk and talk. And now, obviously, this is a critical stage in history where it changed. Abarbanel has rejected both of those approaches and has said that there was always, even in the Garden of Eden, one kind of snake, the same kind of snake you and I would see at the zoo. Aye, how could such a snake do what the Torah describes it as doing? Says the Abarbanel, again, if it would be the Abarbanel, you might accuse me of heresy for even saying such a theory, He says the Torah is speaking not just in theory or in metaphor, but almost in basically the psychological delusions of Chava. The Torah is describing what Chava perceived, even though it wasn't reality. So when Chava thought the snake's telling her, eat the fruit, it's really that she saw a regular snake hanging around the tree, eating the fruits, and it got her so incited for the fruit that she became almost obsessed with, to the point that she imagined that was happening. Right? We would call such a thing a psychotic break. And delusion, says the Barbanel, that's the Torah's describing. That's what happened to Chava. So we've seen him employ this number of times, but we've constantly been waiting for, if the snake didn't do anything wrong, according to the Barbanel, so why does the snake get punished, right? The Barbanel can't get out of that pasuk. Harry's question, 2 or 3 months ago, I don't remember exactly how long ago. So Harry, the Barbanel is ready to meet you. High noon. One-on-one. And you didn't even bring your wife here to defend you. So this way, in case the Barbanel was that victorious, she didn't see it. Says the Barbanel, and with this we'll conclude. He says, listen, if you look at the story here, this didn't just all go to, you know, like nothing, like no tragedy. It didn't all happen at once. There were a lot of steps leading up to this tragedy. But HaNachash, again, this is even the Abarbanel, who understands the story as I described it, he still tries to, so to speak, thread the needle here. And there's no question that this is going to be the hardest pasuk for him to explain in the whole parak. Even so, says the Abarbanel, middle of the first line, HaNachash Rishon B'Mash Asa. The snake was the first cause of the problem. Aisha Charkov, only the woman came next. And finally, Adam. So what's going on here when Hashem talks to the snake? Since when do people or God talk to snakes? Says the Barbanel, end of the second line. Eino Shediber HaKadosh Baruch Hu Imo. It's not. Again, once again, the Barbanel says it's not that God was talking to the snake. So who talks to snakes? Rather, what's being referred to here is not a conversation. El Shigozra Alav Kolze. It's the pronouncement. God is speaking to all of us, to history, into the sky, to Adam and Chava. He's pronouncing it, but he wasn't actually talking to the snake. Why? Shanakosh lo diber. Snakes don't talk, and if they don't talk, you can't really talk to them. The loitziatanos, the snake didn't talk or incite Chava to do anything. So you would have thought, Harry, that if that it's all or nothing, that if the snake didn't do that, then the snake must be completely innocent. Barbanel tries to have his cake and eat it too, tries to say no. Even though the snake was a regular snake who just did what I said, the snake was still considered responsible. Haya siba l'chol hara hazos ba'alaso al ha'et ha'kibiyahei ba'achlo mipiryo. Bottom line, looking at the story, there were a lot of other trees the snake could have chosen. The snake chose to squirm up and eat the fruit of this tree, and that incited Chava. The snake is still considered responsible. He is the siba, that's a strong word. He is still the cause, even for just doing, quote-unquote, just doing what the Abarbanel understands him to have done. And then he adds, kilulas hanachash ladati hi achas. And in light of that, he says, there's one punishment for the snake, not two or even three, just one. And everything else a result of that. Namely, next line, originally, all the snakes were herbivores, all the animals were herbivores, all they did was supposed to eat the fruits and the vegetables and the grass. And the snake was no different from a cow and a horse and a donkey and an elephant in that regard. All of the animals had nice, pleasant dispositions, they weren't troublemakers, and the snake shouldn't have been a troublemaker either. Right? You are what you eat, says the Abarbanel. If you eat certain kinds of food, it's going to affect your temperament. And the snake should have been as nice and as docile as all the other animals. When God originally created the snake, it was no more evil and no more dangerous and no more of a conniver than any other animal in the garden. Om nam. But with a capital B. Da-da-da-dum. The snake was too smart for its own good. What is the opening pasuk? That the snake was arum mikol, right? It's the smartest animal in the field. Well, the snake, given how smart he was, wasn't happy just eating a diet like everyone else. He wasn't happy with just eating the grass like everybody else. He wanted to eat like a human, and not just like any human. He wanted that tree. It went up that squirrel, right? It squirmed up the tree and ate that. Therefore, Niskalel B'Sheshino HaKadosh Baruch Hu Tivo Umizgo. And what's the ultimate curse of the snake? That in so doing, HaKadosh Baruch Hu changes its temperament. V'as'o afaryi. It made it, again, I'm not even sure if there's a translation for such a word. It made it base, dirt-y. Dirt-oriented, dirt-ish, dirt-esque. Right? It used to be elevated like other animals, and it became afaryi. Became, that's how we understand it. Well, then that more, and that's what the pasuk means when it says you are going to be cursed from all the other animals in the field because you could have been like everyone else, and because of you, your own arrogance, you got yourself into trouble. Below ta'ale od alat esadeh, and therefore as a result, you'll never ever go back up the tree. Aval yeh mezoncha milvada afar. It's just going to be this lower level dirt. But avor zen, once that's where your diet comes from, it follows. Right? Hashem is doing you a favor. And what's the point of having all these other tendencies and that you're going to want to be, you know, swinging from the trees like the monkey when all your food is really down below? Now, I don't know how if this really implies that he assumes it's very literal about the offer. I'm not sure what to do with that point. But the bottom line is, I'm not, if you had to ask me, I think there was, I think, four Barbanels that we saw, this is his weakest. This is the biggest fight, because conversely, this is the strongest pasuk to take as what otherwise would be almost fantasy world and assume it was really true, that the snake was really a walking, talking being, which is why so many mafarshim, even people like the Radak and Ibn Ezra, feel compelled to read the whole perek in light of that. It's really because at the end, if you remember, it was Ibn Ezra who really wanted to do, Ibn Ezra was doing everything he could at the beginning of the perek to read this as not being a walking, talking snake. And why did he end up having to fold? Because of this pasuk. This is the ultimate pasuk. The Abar Benel, you know, if you will, you could call it courageous. I'm not sure. Or, you know, one man's courage is another man's foolishness. You know, he does not want to give in even on this most strong pasuk. So even though other pasukim, he has, I would say, a more compelling argument, he makes the effort here. But again, it is sort of forced. And that's how he tries to, again, because it's hard to understand, as the other Mepharshim said, but if the snake was just eating, so maybe the snake did something wrong, but you can't punish it for what resulted from that. And yet the Abarbanel does seem to acknowledge, as the Torah does, that the snake is considered culpable, not only for what it did, but for what resulted. I guess the best explanation I can give, if I wanted to just defend this Abarbanel, is you do have this notion. I'm not 100% sure if there would be an exact parallel in halacha, but I know that there is in American criminal law, right? You get punished if there's a foreseeable consequence. You can be held liable. So, for example, if two people are part of a stick-up, right, and the bank teller gets killed or something, even though I just drove the car, I didn't go anywhere near the gun, both can be indicted and charged with murder, right? Because if you do something like this, you're accepting responsibility for an inevitable consequence. So perhaps that's what the Abarbanel is saying. Even though the snake just did what it did for its own instinctive, biological reasons, it wanted more fruit and didn't want to eat the boring grass, the bottom line is the Abarbanel says, well, you know what? By you breaking the law, you made Chava jealous. She wanted to do it, even though you weren't talking to her, because who are you? You're just a snake. But because that all resulted from your actions, God felt within his rights, you know, judiciously, to punish the snake. Really very interesting stuff. Emir Tzah Hashem will pick up with Chava as punishment next week.